Hello, fellow baseball nuts, and a big warm welcome to show number 3 of the Johnny and Josh Show with that chap that used to produce in the background. Great pleasure to welcome all of you, all our listeners. Thank you so much for joining us on the journey. Amazing we've made show number 3. Usually it's 3 strikes and we're out, JC, but we're back.
Well, Goldie, I have to lead off by wishing you a very happy birthday. Now, my maths aren't great, but I think this is your 75th, and you don't look a day over 59.
That is so kind. That is so kind. It was indeed my birthday on Wednesday, and I was indeed 59, the last year in my youth. Eric, you've not even close to 59, but thankfully look a lot older.
Well, you know what? I was going to say that if this was Logan's run, you'd be long dead by now. But so would we all.
And if great reference right there to Logan's run. Yeah.
The problem is, if you get that reference, you're old.
You're old. Guilty as charged.
Well, guys, I got to say, I'm feeling old with all that we've endured in the first sort of, second full week of Major League Baseball, with all the stories that abound, the question marks about whether things are going to continue. But we're still here. As long as there's baseball to talk about, that will be a reality for all the UK baseball fans out there. And Eric, I know that you will each and every week continue the show at the top with the trivia.
Eric Stumper, the in-game trivia, whatever you want to call it. But it's also relevant because a quirky fact that happened this week in baseball is that Max Scherzer struck out Vladimir Guerrero Jr. almost 10 years to the day after striking out his dad, Vlad Guerrero Sr. Is that incredible?
That's incredible.
But he's still not as old as you, Johnny.
Ten days would have been more incredible.
That would be very incredible. Yeah. So the question to you today is, let's keep the father-son combo thing happening, is which father-son duo have combined most home runs in Major League Baseball? Cogitate, nice. Think about it over the course of the show.
Baseball is such a family business. You know, you think of all the fathers and sons, Tito and Terry Francona. My favorite is the Boone family. You had Ray Boone, the grandfather, then you had Bob Boone, the son, and then you had Aaron Boone and Brett Boone as the grandchildren. They all made it to the majors. That's the type of athletic prowess that none of us have or will give to our children.
Which is why you should always call your kid Junior. Isn't that right? Because at the end of the day, it just highlights the fact that Senior was there, Junior was there. I always wanted to be named after my father until I realized he was called Gordon Clifford. And then on second thoughts, I changed my mind.
good choice.
Well, he's not with us anymore, Dad, so I can't insult him. God rest his soul. Bless you, Pops. Love you loads. Now, guys, that's enough talk about the trivia, which actually I think is relatively easy. Certainly, a couple of names spring to mind, Eric, and that's very sweet of you to include me in the in-game trivia, which normally I'd have absolutely no hope. So we're going to kick the game off, as always, with our first pitch of the day and a big story, the story that's dominating the airwaves, JC, which is, of course, COVID, unfortunately, on every result, is eking its way poisonously into Major League Baseball, with the Miami Marlins at the center of the story. Latest I heard, 18 players, 2 staff, all tested positive. It's had a huge impact on the schedule. In fact, I was looking at the schedule. You look in the National League East. I think the average of all the teams in Major League Baseball at the moment, between 9 and 7 games played. You've got the Marlins and the Phillies have only played 3 times. And in the National League Central, you've got the Brewers and only played 6 times. The Cardinals only played 5 times. So those are the two divisions that are being impacted big time. Obviously, the important issue here to stress is safety is at the core. But the knock-on effect is, one, the question, can we possibly continue the season if this continues in the way it has in the last week or so, to the point where you've even had the commissioner coming out saying, unless you buck your ideas up in terms of how you deal with what is the strategy of Major League Baseball to deal with COVID, unless you take it seriously, and there are question marks that they haven't been taking it seriously, particularly in Miami, that this will end the season. What's your thoughts? It's a massive story, JC, and it impacts on everything.
Goldie, I hate to say it, but I feel that baseball is as much circus as it is sport right now. And if you are thinking about whether the season's going to be completed, I would sort of put it in a flip of a coin, because there are two issues here. One is, are the protocols strong enough? And two, are the players adhering to these protocols? And both sides are pointing fingers. So you don't have a cohesive unit between ownership and players all sort of rowing the boat in the same direction. And that causes a tremendous amount of problems. Players have to take everything really seriously and go above and beyond whatever the protocols are. But the protocols do need to be robust. And David Price, who opted out this season, pitching for the Los Angeles Dodgers, great pitcher, he has gone to Twitter a number of times to say, look, this is proof positive that ownership is not putting the safety of players first. And we have tangible results from this. We talked about the Marlins, 18 players who have been tested as COVID positive. It's unclear with other teams, but the St. Louis Cardinals clearly have a number of players, as many as four. It depends on which media outlet you're looking at. But to me, the story that came out this week that is most troubling is Eduardo Rodriguez, the pitcher for the Boston Red Sox, who said that he won't play the rest of the season because he had a heart damage from his COVID positive experience. So there are tangible long-term impacts from this. To me, the most ghoulish story that's come out thus far is the story. And again, there's so much media statements that are going on that we don't know if it's accurate, but the story that really hit me was the one about the Marlins apparently putting the 18 players and two personnel or whatever that number is on a bus, a sleeper bus from Philadelphia to drive them back to Miami. It's like the bus of the damned. It's just so wrong. And if people aren't thinking about the humanity of this first, there's no point. I heard the phrase, and you've probably heard this too, that sports should be a reward for a properly functioning society. I don't know if we want to go that far, but there certainly needs to be certain standards in place to keep this going, and it's unclear whether those standards are there right now.
Eric, tough times always need strong leaders, and Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, was very, very tough with the Major League Baseball Player Association head Tony Clark, saying, you know, sort this out from a player level or this is going to end the season. And yet, having made that statement, he's now come out and almost contradicted himself, and he's come out with comments, no reason to quit now. He's now trying to put a more positive spin on it. What are your thoughts? What's your input?
The criticism that Major League Baseball is getting nowadays is perhaps they should have done what the NHL and the NBA have done. The NHL have two hub cities, one in Toronto and one in Edmonton, where they're playing the remainder of their playoffs, while the NBA is doing a bubble in Orlando. Meanwhile, Major League teams are boarding buses, boarding planes, and flying all across the country. But has that contributed? Well, probably.
Yeah, I mean, there are just so many choices that have been made here that are questionable. I think one of the big criticisms is that Major League Baseball took 3 days, just 3 days, to put together their protocol for COVID, and that doesn't seem right. And even if the season goes on, we should note that there will be very systemic changes to the way we see baseball. Most notably, they're going to have a number of doubleheaders in order to try and come close to completing the season. And rather than nine-inning games, which are the standard for Major League games, they're going to play seven-inning games. Now, at the minor league level, that's something that's done. It's done at the college level. But at the major league level, you don't really see seven-inning games. So that's going to change the strategy of the sport if we do continue.
And you talk about the protocol that has been in place and the fact that it was done as quickly as it did. And in a sense, that was almost an inevitability. But there were some things that were ignored and missed on, particularly having every single team having a representative, a neutral representative, to ensure the protocol was being followed. Because the stories about Miami, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, JC, they're talking about players going out to a party, when they were in Philadelphia, which would suggest that they, and players not wearing masks at the appropriate times, and players spitting, and players just breaking all the very basic rules, and there was no one there to oversee it.
But this is the problem with, we're getting little bits of information, and a lot of them are probably being placed by one side or the other. There's an antagonistic relationship between ownership and the players' union. And I think that one of the things that Manfred has done on his side, and I think it's true on the players' side too, is to try and point the fingers squarely at the other side. Derek Jeter did this when he put out a statement about the Marlins saying, we didn't do anything wrong, we were fine. And you see that Manfred's saying, oh, I think these stories about the parties and so forth, they may or may not be true, but they're definitely being leaked out there to say, our protocols were robust, it's the players' fault. So this is a huge problem for Major League Baseball moving forward, because if you have this type of tension, and we have collective bargaining coming up down the road, these two sides are going to be in no place to want to discuss anything or come to any deals.
And just to round this one off, Eric, JC's already referenced about the knock-on effect of COVID, not just people testing positive, but the physical impact, players missing the season as a result. But also, there's now the issue of players opting it out. We mentioned at the top of the season that there were, I think at the time, were 13, and we said, well, there's bound to be more. And there is more. I think it's now up to 18 players. And the big name, Lorenzo Cain from the Brewers, has just announced he's decided to opt out for the rest of the season. I mean, this is one side effect that just could get worse and worse unless they get on top of this.
See, and it's happening so early into the season. The season's just barely a week old. And I look back to 1919, not that I was there, but the Spanish flu pandemic, where the NHL season was affected. If you look at the Stanley Cup, where there was no winner for the 1919 Stanley Cup final. That's because right in the middle of the Spanish flu epidemic, Montreal Canadiens were playing the then Seattle Metropolitans, and a player died because of the Spanish flu, and the rest of the team was hospitalized. So that happened in the final. Right now we're seeing this in the early season of baseball. Will we even get to the World Series? Will it halt the World Series, mid-World Series? Time will tell.
You say it's early, though, Eric, but we're 9 games in for some teams. It's a 60-game season, so we're actually, you know, vastly beyond 10% of the season. So
that's true.
For as short as it's been, we're actually moving into almost the middle part.
There you go. On that note.
All right, let's move on to our second pitch. There has been action on the field, and probably the most notable story from the diamond this week had to do with a relief pitcher by the name of Joe Kelly. Last week we talked about Trash Can Gate, the big scandal that involved the Houston Astros hitting a trash can while using high technology from cameras all around the field in order to alert batters on their team as to what pitch was coming. In 2017, the Houston Astros won the World Series using Trash Can Gate. And the question was there going to be retribution? And we got our answer potentially this week with Joe Kelly. Gouldy, tell us a little bit about what Mr. Kelly, as a relief pitcher for the Los Angeles Dodgers, did when he faced the Astros lineup.
Well, as you know, JC, and all our listeners, though, Joe Kelly is renowned as a bit of a character, a man who dances salsa out in the outfield, who's dressed up to do interviews and pretending to be somebody else. This guy is a maverick as an individual, let alone as a baseball player, former Cardinal, former Boston Red Sox, now with the Dodgers. And as you rightly say, playing against the Astros Tuesday night and through, first of all, I think it was a 96-mile-per-hour fastball behind the head of Alex Bregman, which obviously got tempers flying a little bit. And then did something similar, actually hit Carlos Correa, putting him on base, sticking his tongue out at him. And basically, my understanding, and I need you to clarify this, he wasn't actually evicted from the game on the night.
Yeah, no sanctions. No sanctions whatsoever on the night. That's
but
the key.
That's the key. So the umpires didn't deem what he'd done to be worthy of being ejected. And yet, in response to this game and the suggestion that it was payback time, they've decided, MLB, in their wisdom, to hand down an 8-game suspension. Now, if this was a regular 162-game season, that is the equivalent of 21 games. The norm for this sort of offense is 2-5. So that puts in perspective how ludicrously over the top the suspension is. Dave Roberts, the Dodgers manager, he had a 1-game ban for his involvement. Dusty Baker, who apparently was mouthing off obscenities, and I love Dusty Baker from his Giants days, who's now the new manager of the Astros, he was fined an undisclosed amount. He did not suffer a 1-game ban. So it is abundantly clear that the decision was made by MLB to come down heavy, to say that this sort of retribution by teams against the Astros because of Trash Can Gate will not be accepted. And yet, as a result of what's happened, everyone's gone, it's ridiculously over the top, and no one can believe that they seem to come out in support of a team where no player has suffered a sanction for directly cheating to win the 2017 World Series. Joe Kelly now, JC, is everyone's hero, unless you're an Astros fan.
Yeah, I mean, he's a folk hero in Los Angeles now. And I think you hit the irony right on the head with your statement that all the players who were involved in that 2017 just detailed effort to try and, you know, sort of go around, sidestep the rules and cheat, none of them None of them got in trouble. And here's Joe Kelly with just sort of a really expanded sentence for his action. And I think you need to go back to the actual events and really determine to what extent was he throwing at hitters. Now, the first pitch to Bregman, it was a 3-0 count. So that he was probably going to let him get on base anyway. And so I wouldn't be surprised if he airmailed one over Bregman's head as sort of a statement. But the second wild pitch to Carlos Correa, I don't believe he did that one on purpose, even though that also went over his head. And the reason for that is that it ended up being a wild pitch. It moved runners up. It was a 5-2 game. And all of a sudden, you have runners on second and third, and you have a great hitter up with the opportunity to bring them within one run with a base hit or a home run to tie it. There's no way that he was doing that. And I think the proof was in the pudding that he ended up striking out Correa. So was he really as aggressive in trying to send a message to the Astros as potentially suggested by some? I think no way. Was he trying to send some sort of message? I think probably.
Eric, you are such a fan of the traditions. You're a purist. You're so unbelievably old-fashioned in everything you do in life, and we love you for it. This has been a part of the game. It is unique, baseball, in that it self-polices. And that is ultimately what is happening here. So do you feel the reaction of MLB is completely out of tune with the essence of the game of baseball?
Either way, let's face it, it's good television. I mean, the fans are loving it. Where it's that's how many highlights do you see all across, you know, every social platform from this that one game, from that one moment.
Eric's cold-hearted. He wants to see, like, people fighting to the death on his screen.
Unfortunately, like I mentioned, unfortunately, right now, fighting bench-clearing brawls, it looks more like, you know, a dance in West Side Story because of social distancing. But
that's an interesting sort of element to this as well, too, right? Is that the bench is cleared, but there was no bench-clearing brawl, and that's probably because of COVID. I think you would have seen a pretty intense bench-clearing brawl.
Oh, completely.
I want to throw something out here, okay? I was watching a number of shows in America about this issue, talk shows where they're all getting into it in a big way, and there's some amazing footage of Joe Kelly in his garden preseason, trying to stay fit, trying to stay warm, and he had this big net with a target, and he throws a fastball at it. Now you, Eric, could hit that target.
It wasn't a fastball. It was a changeup. In his defense, he was working on a new pitch. It was sort of a circle change.
And but he missed the whole net.
He broke a window in his house.
Exactly. I mean, the old adage, you know, you can't hit a barn door. He couldn't hit the barn, let alone the door, and which would suggest that, you know, he's renowned for being a bit wild. And I, the only aspect of it is I don't like the idea of a 96-mile-per-hour fastball going near a person's head because that can kill someone. And I think that is wrong. I just wonder, having watched the pitch count, you said yourself it was 3-0 against Bregman. I'm not even sure that was deliberate. You think it was, JC? You know a lot more about this than I do, but it doesn't look that deliberate to me.
I will tell you the one interesting element that occurred after that, and Joe Kelly's quote after the game was, quote, "My accuracy isn't the best," end quote, which is actually true throughout his career, and teams have given up on him despite having electric stuff. After he walked Bregman, he threw over twice, at least twice, to first base to force Bregman to slide back hard, which is sort of a way to sort of send a message in and of itself. So that suggests that there was certainly bad blood there and he was doing something. But again, with the Correa wild pitch, I think that was completely just an inaccurate throw.
Okay. One last thing to say, Eric, the man has some form. He is a character, Joe Kelly. Do you feel the sticking out of the tongue? Do you feel the yawn that he did after I think he'd walked Bregman? Do you think those things perhaps were unnecessary and that perhaps is why the Astros got so incensed and why the commissioner got so incensed?
No, I think it's exactly what the game needs. You know, it needs to draw people back to watching baseball again. And like I said, the Twitter was lit up. Every social media platform was lit up with that one game.
There are already T-shirts out there with him doing the bottom lip, like the sad bottom lip look from Joe Kelly.
Nice swing. That
was the money shot, right? Of him
sort
of staring over at Correa with the bottom lip, like, oh, you little baby.
Right, people are still talking about him.
I'm going to round it up with a quote from Marcus Stroman. I think it was a tweet where he says, "Makes zero sense." This is with regards to the punishment. He wasn't even thrown out of the game. MLB siding with / protecting a team that openly and knowingly cheated their way to a World Series. That's another player. That's the player's view. It's a big story, and I agree with you guys. It's a great story.
Almost brought out the waffle there, but wasn't really necessary. That was a good way to end it.
You just
the waffle's
to have
been
it
sitting quietly thus far.
It's getting stale. That's why we got to hurry up the show so I can eat it.
Did you actually buy the waffle 3 weeks ago, or is it a new one every week?
It's just moving on.
You need to go on our social media on Facebook. You took a picture of him at the.
I always prepare for the show. You know.
Okay, well, pitch number two was a bit wild, but pitch number three, I'm in control here, like guys, and it's going to be right over the plate. JC, athletes now going beyond their careers into ownership. It's become a big story over there. We know A-Rod, Jeter in particular, who's the CEO in Miami, with only a 4% stake. That's bizarre. That shows you what a superstar you are. You only have to have 4%, but you're still the CEO. But there's other names as well. Jordan, of course, of the NBA. And now Patrick Mahomes, the legendary Kansas City quarterback, the Chiefs quarterback, and Super Bowl winner, who's now taken out a stake in the Royals, in the Kansas City Royals. Tell us more.
What I love about this story with Patrick Mahomes is that, first off, his dad was a major league pitcher, so he has a connection to baseball. He pitched a little bit at Texas Tech. But, you know, if you or I were ever to sign a big contract, probably, you know, buy a family member a house or go out and get a Lambo or something like that, he signs the $503 million contract. He takes it to the next level. He's like, I'm going to buy part of a sports franchise. And to me, what's interesting about Mahomes, less so, but more about the Jeters and A-Rod and his effort to purchase the New York Mets. He's part of one of the potential ownership groups there. Is to what extent does that change the game? It really shows, first off, that we're at a time and place where players are getting compensated, at least at the top level, to extreme amounts that they can have enough money to actually buy into these teams. But are they going to bring to the table a attitude and approach that protects players and to try and level the playing field for them? I'd say initial instances suggest not. You look at Derek Jeter, he became the CEO of the Marlins after purchasing part of the team. And one of his first actions was to get rid of Andre Dawson and Tony Perez, who were both ambassadors for the team, who were making minuscule amounts of money in those roles because he was trying to cut a little bit of payroll. You look at A-Rod, who's talking about, and he didn't mention it specifically, but the intention was there that he was suggesting there should be a salary cap, which any player would sort of wince at. It's a really negative element in terms of salary. So it's interesting to see these players taking these roles and then really shifting over to the ownership side.
Eric, we remember well our coming together at the 2008 All-Star Game with Mr. Jeter. I mean, he had a reputation of being Mr. Baseball, clean cut, great ambassador of the sport. Do you feel that there's a danger when you go into ownership, you perhaps tar that reputation?
Oh, yeah, it tarnishes it completely. I mean, you look back at other franchises. You look back at, let's go back to the NHL. Mario Lemieux bought, who was a legend at the Pittsburgh Penguins, bought the Pittsburgh Penguins, saved the club, and they've had successful cup runs and they've got silverware in the trophy cabinet and everything. But then you look at other legends like Michael Jordan, it's not going so well. It's, you know, he's, and I'm trying to think of other franchises that
Magic Johnson had an
Magic Johnson. Oh, well, there you go. So Magic Johnson crossing over to a different sport, being an NBA legend, the LA Lakers, owning the Dodgers. Look at the Dodgers now. So it's, it either tarnishes it or you become another hero on another level.
But I think the point you're making is that it really does vary in terms of how involved they are. So Mahomes is going to be a minority stake in the Royals. He's not going to do much. Jeter is a frontline person. And I think this is a reminder. I always think back to Ted Williams, one of the greatest players of all time. He became a manager primarily with the Washington Senators and the Texas Rangers and was a pretty bad manager by most accounts. I mean, his win-loss was okay, but he would sort of get out there and say, like, why can't you hit like me? And a lot of players sort of groused at that. And I wonder to what extent when these players become owners, that they have a difficulty making that transition too.
Wayne Gretzky as well, another case in point, you know, the legend of any sport pretty much, and didn't go too well with the Coyotes, both as part owner or head coach.
Is this an ego thing? Because obviously over in this part of the world, certainly in the world of rugby, the world of football, you expect superstar players, there's a good chance they may become managers, may become coaches. But this is not about being a manager or a coach, it's about being an owner. Is it more of an ego thing?
Well, I think with all these people, the competitive drive is there, right? So they all feel that they understand the sport. Most of these players, by definition, have had tremendous success or they wouldn't have the money in order to own the team. So for some of them, they think it is more of a reflection of their stature to be ownership rather than to be a manager. And that's the reason they're going in that direction. I think, you know, Jeter, he's such an icon that he probably felt, well, I could be in the dugout and we could have up years and down years, but by being an owner, it sort of shows my elevated status.
And one thing I like to, when we get David Langille on our show, we should ask him, how does it feel like being a long-suffering Mets fan, having potentially A-Rod as the owner of your own team? It's like, that's like Roy Keane buying Liverpool.
The level of profanity will be, we're going to have to get your bell to be beeping out his bad words.
But the conversation I want to be a fly on the wall for is when these new owner players get together and have a chat. And Patrick Mahomes has just signed an extension to his contract worth $503 million. And he has a chat with A-Rod about salary caps. I mean, that's going to be well worth listening in on. Anyway, that's pitch 1, 2, and 3.
Well-oiled machine. We're moving along.
All right. So now we can move on to our changeup, a slightly different off-the-wall topic that we touch on that may not directly be on-field action. And everything's a pitch here. We're going to go to a different kind of pitch. We're going to talk about the honorary first pitch, something Gouldy knows about, I know about. We didn't talk about it last week, but before the Yankees-Nationals game, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's been a key figure in the COVID fight here in the United States, went onto the mound and threw an honorary first pitch. It was less than desirable. If anyone wants to go on YouTube and check it out, it was a bit of a yeesh moment. Fauci this week did talk a little bit about it, said that he had thrown a lot beforehand, and with his son, his arm was a little sore. The adrenaline got the best of him, and he tried to overthrow it when he could have lobbed, and there was a mistake. Adding to the drama of this first pitch was President Donald Trump, who potentially was jealous of Fauci getting this honor and claimed that in August he was going to throw out a first pitch for the Yankees. Now, people asked the Yankees whether this was true, and the Yankees said they were unaware of this. There had been an open invitation to Trump. Generally speaking, Randy Levine, who is the president of the Yankees, had given him that open offer, but there was nothing specific. And then Trump basically then turned down this imaginary offer. But it all brings back this idea that the honorary first pitch is very honorary. And we thought we'd spend a few minutes here. Gouldy, maybe you can go through some of your favorite worst first pitches. And then we can talk about your first pitch, which was actually, begrudgingly, I must say, pretty excellent.
Yeah, so we're doing that last, are we? I assume that'd be top of the bill.
I want you to earn it, Gouldy, because I know how excited you are to talk about it.
Can I just talk a little bit about Dr. Anthony Fauci and Donald Trump? Because you've referenced the two. Obviously, the backstory to this is there is a bit of jealousy and spite involved. The doctor has been doing a roaring job, doing his absolute best with regards to corona, and has apparently gone head-to-head and is not very popular with the president or with the White House. Therefore, there is this sort of undercurrent, this agenda that's going on. I like the sound of this man. We should reference the fact he's 79 years old. So he hasn't thrown a baseball in fury for probably 20, 25 years. But he did say, because it was one of the worst I've ever seen. I mean, just to let people know, it literally went off at 45 degrees. And he joked that he used to be a shortstop growing up. So he thought he was meant to be throwing to first base. And I love that. I love that humility. That was funny. Whereas, as you say, Trump came in with this ridiculous story saying that he was throwing out that it had been agreed that he was going to be throwing out the first pitch for the Yankees in Madrid. And of course, he is known to be a big Yankee fan, used to be massive fans, massive friends with the former owner, George Steinbrenner. But it's what Trump said about his baseball career that is so extraordinary. Talked about how he was supposed to be a pro baseball player, that he was said to be America's best and brightest on the power of sports when he was in school. He even says that he went for a tryout, but he went for a tryout with some guy called Willie McCovey, who, when he realized how good he realized possibly I'm not that good. Willie McCovey is 8 years older than Donald Trump. How the hell did they go for a tryout?
Going, a few little trivia facts about presidential Samuel first pitch. We all remember George W. Bush in 2001 World Series, right over the plate. Over the plate, wearing a bulletproof vest. Bill Clinton actually would do it over the plate when one of his presidential pitches. Language. Tell me, show. But here's an interesting one. The first left-handed president to throw out someone first.
Obama?
Pitch. No, it was Harry S. Truman.
Harry S. Truman. Well, I know Obama's lefty too, right?
Yeah, but Harry was the first. But also, Gerald Ford was the first ambidextrous.
The first pitcher ever to throw out an honorary first pitch was? I think I know this.
It was Taft.
It was Taft, yeah, William Howard Taft.
That's right, 110 years ago. But here's the thing: is like when Gerald Ford did it, because he was ambidextrous, he did it at the 1976 All-Star game. So he threw one for the NL with his right arm and one with the AL with his left arm.
Ford was a good athlete. He played football at University of Michigan.
He did. Yeah. Oh, by the way, my favorite president at opening day stat, Lyndon B. Johnson ate 4 hot dogs in one sitting. How's that?
A man after your own heart.
Yeah, you know, 100%. I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican. You get my vote for that.
He's also a man who took meetings on the toilet. So, again, a man after Erickson.
That's because he ate 4 hot dogs in one sitting.
Guys, I want to pick up on this 110-year tradition of the American presidents, because Trump is going to be the first president since who not to throw out a first pitch at a professional baseball game whilst in office if he loses the election. Who was the last president in the 110 years? There you go. JC? Eric?
I think it's Jimmy Carter.
It's not? No?
Because I think he couldn't make it because of the Iran hostage crisis. I thought that was out. Am I wrong?
Well, the stat that I was – he will be the first president since Teddy Roosevelt.
Interesting.
Teddy Roosevelt. So there you go. So, I mean, it really is a proud tradition. And we'll finish this, guys, talking about Trump, because you all know, always need to finish on Trump. Having made the claim that he was the greatest athlete at his school, you mentioned the school, it was the New York Military Academy, JC. Apparently, in the yearbook, the most athletic and the school's Laidlaw Athletic Award, which is basically for the most athletic, went to a guy called Jim Toomey. But Donald Trump did win one award in that yearbook. Do you know what it was?
Go on.
Ladies' man.
Surprise, surprise. On that note,
God save this world. That's all I gotta say. Please save us.
I couldn't resist. I'm sorry. Okay, great stuff, guys. Great innings. 1, 2, 3 out, and a foosball.
You are mixing your metaphors. We're pitching innings.
We're 3 innings. That was a great inning.
The sunflower seed break. Yeah. Let's just throw it all out there.
I'm a little bit out there, which is rather appropriate and a nice segue for our next section, because we had an interview, or should I say Eric did, with a true legend of the game. And the more I've read about this man, the more I've looked forward to hearing what he had to say. William Francis Lee III, the spaceman, former Red Sox, former Montreal Expos, in the company of the Expos legendary fan that is Eric Jensen.
Well, I'm more than overjoyed to have this next guest, obviously, who's a Montreal legend, a Boston legend, and just a baseball legend, one of the few characters in the game that left his imprint, kind of thing. Left-handed pitcher for the Boston Red Sox from 1969 to 1978, and then joined the illustrious Montreal Expos until 1982. I am talking, of course, of Bill Lee, the spaceman. Welcome aboard.
Well, thanks for having me over on the other side of the pond. I know you guys play cricket a lot. The Dutch seem to dominate European baseball. I've worked with the Russians. I've worked in Italy and taught the little Italians to play a little bit. But I'd like to see Great Britain make a really good team. I'd like to see foreigners playing baseball. I think it brings world peace. Baseball, I said, was the belly button of the world. And if you play baseball, there's no time. The defense controls the ball, and it can go on forever. And there cannot be wars when you're playing baseball.
Now, I want to talk about characters in the game. You were one of the main characters of the game. Do you think we've lost that flair nowadays? That, you know, I don't think we can really count any characters in the game nowadays. We had
there's one, Trevor Bauer.
And I guess Joey Votto, the good Canadian boy as well, could be a considered a character.
I dedicated my last book, the book I've just finished called The Spaceman Chronicles, I to Trevor Bauer for throwing that ball over the center field fence, for speaking out, for being in it. I dedicated the whole book to individuality. That's the great thing about the game. You know, you have the old characters, Babe Ruth, you know, he wouldn't be able to hold a job. All the old players seem to have character and development, and that's what made the game beautiful.
Now, you're still playing baseball today. Is that correct? And what capacity? Tell me about this.
I throw anything. I throw my trash this way. I throw darts in Jamaica. I can throw anything, and my arm is in great shape. And so I was going to call the Red Sox because they need starting pitching. If they bunted on me, I'd be in trouble. But I can play every day. I do my calisthenics. I do my Gus Hoffling. I do my wax on, wax off.
You've never left baseball. Baseball's never left you.
No, thank you. I'm on the roster of seven teams, and I make baseball bats. I make wine. So all I do is I drink, I hit, and I bat, you know, and that's
do,
it.
Do you think, obviously, like when you were in your heyday in the 70s, cusping into the 80s, mm-hmm. do you think the way you were then, would you be able to play baseball, Major League Baseball today? Or has the game changed that much?
No, it hasn't changed. I tell people, I can't throw, but I can pitch. In other words, throwing and pitching are two different objects. Guys can throw, but can they add and subtract? I can subtract. I have a good curveball. I won a pro game at 61. 63, I pitched in Brockton and won professionally. At 65, I pitched a complete game for the San Rafael Pacifics and drove in a run. I'm the oldest guy to ever score a run, drive in a run, and throw a complete game at the age of 65, pro ball. At 67, they traded me to Sonoma, and I ended up pitching that game. They didn't want me to pitch because it was the last game of the season. They needed to win it to get the playoffs, and I said, what am I, freaking, you know, sliced bologna or supper? And I went out and I won that ball game. And 70, when I hit 70, I could see the end was near because gravity was starting to hurt my knees and stuff. But if I could lose about 20 pounds, I can play it till I'm 90.
Well, that's what we'll hold you to that, hopefully.
Hold me to that. I have never played on a losing ball club. I am blessed because wherever I go, I'm infectious. I'm kind of like COVID-19, you know. You really love it. I give you the disease of playing baseball till you die, and that's a disease I think every child should inherit.
Let's rewind the clock back to 1975.
Yeah. Ooh.
Game 7 World Series, you were the starting pitcher for the Boston Red Sox.
Yeah.
Was it quite a lot of pressure on you thinking, wow, it's up to me to break the curse of the Bambino on the mound?
Well, I had the lead, and then I got a blister on my finger, and I walked Geronimo, and he turned out to be the tie-in run. And if we had turned the double play in the sixth inning, Perez doesn't hit the two-run homer off me. But here's what we do. Wind the clock back. If I win game 2, I have a 2-1 lead in the ninth inning. Okay? I have a 2-1 lead, and we have a rain delay, and they send me back out there. During the rain delay, Johnny Bench in game 2 was on there with Kurt Gowdy and the other announcer, Joe Garagiola. And they went, Lee's pitching me tough. I'm going to have to hit him into right field. 43 million Americans were watching that. Do you think one of them would have told me? None of them. And I ended up throwing him a sinker low and away, and he drove it into the right field corner. If I had known that, I would have thrown him a fastball up and in or an overhand deuce down and in and got him to roll over and hit a ground ball. Then if we win game 2, when Fisk hits the home run in game 6, we win the World Series. There should never have been a game 7.
Now, I remember those, obviously, Montreal years fondly, might I add. Those were stellar years, those late 70s into the early 80s. I thought we were going to go all the way those years with you, part of that pitching staff as well. And do you think Montreal, will baseball ever return to Montreal? Is it too soon? Do you think there's no infrastructure involved? You know more than anybody else that baseball return to Montreal is a pipe dream or is it reality?
It's reality because Expos were the first team outside of the United States to go pro. And to take it away from the Expos the way they did was inhumane. And they have to go back to Montreal. They have to play there because if we're in the American League East as Montreal Expos, you know, you're going to be playing New York, Boston, Toronto. You're going to draw 4 million people. It's good for baseball, and it has to happen. And I think Manfred was that close to doing it, and then COVID came about. It makes perfect sense economically.
That's true. No, I always said that they should have joined the American League East, and that would have saved the club, I think. And
I agree. And they should do away with the designated hitter. I'm writing a book about 1972, that baseball changed in 72, because the 73, the American League, went to specialization. They went to the DH. And now the DH is in both leagues. They're going to play seven-inning doubleheaders. They put a runner at second with nobody out. You could actually throw a perfect game and lose 1-0. How does that happen?
Now, that's interesting you say that, because one of my bones of contention is interleague. I actually hate interleague. I actually do. This is where we might agree to disagree. I actually do like the separation of AL and NL.
And
interleagues completely ruin that, I say. I always used to say that never should the two leagues meet until they get to the World Series. You were part of that era that was, you know.
You're a purist. There's nothing wrong with that. The thing is, they used to have two baseballs. They had the American League ball and the National League ball. One was made by Reach and one was made by Spalding. They used to separate it totally. I agree. Keep them apart. Keep them like caged wild chickens, and you're right. That makes the World Series a lot better.
But you hate the DH. I actually don't mind the DH being in one league, but having them in both leagues is a travesty, I say.
It's here's the thing. Specialization breeds extinction. Buckminster Fuller wrote that. And every time you become specialized, you lose that ability to think generally and to solve problems.
Now, you're obviously one of the things you're doing as well, and we have Josh Chetwin here who's part of the Johnny and Josh show. He's one of the minor characters of the show. He's written a few books.
Yeah. I got to get his book. I've heard of his name before, and I don't know where I heard it before, but I've got to get his book.
And, it's there's a few. There's, you know, he's got Baseball in Europe, but you've got a few books yourself that you've written. For example, you've got The Wrong Stuff is one of your.
Oh yeah,
which is a very
highly. That's the original. That's kind of like Jack Kerouac's On the Road.
Exactly, and then you got of course Baseball Centrics, of that's which you funny. Are one.
Now
obviously right now you're currently in the middle of writing another book. Have Glove Will Travel is one other classic one of yours. Yeah. But which one you're working on right now?
This one's called the Spaceman Chronicles. It's kind of a revisionist history. This book is going to be a tell-all book, and the Statue of Limitations is not up, and these guys aren't dead.
So actually, not. I guess it wouldn't exactly be a proper book for a bedtime reading to kids, though, I guess.
Oh, no. This is a kid that 14-year-olds want to get a hold of this book. But don't let them. It's definitely PG. It's PG adult, and it's funny.
Right, so we'll tell our viewers and listeners.
Tell the viewers, it's going to be good.
Keep an eye on it online.
Yeah.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Bill, to have you here on the show. And on behalf of the Johnny and Josh show and everyone else that listens here in the UK, we know. I'm sure this is the last we've heard of you as well.
There's
always an open invite if you ever come over to London and or anywhere in the UK.
Well, I'll come. You're in downtown London?
I am.
I got you.
Johnny lives way out in the boondocks, but so do you.
I'll go to the boondocks. We'll meet out there at a pub out there, and we'll find a pitch to play on, and we'll go play. And thank you all for having me. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bill, it's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it. What a treat. William Francis Lee III, the spaceman, with our very own spaceman. Top job, Eric. I love it. And I would love to have Bill down at Bath. I think that man could single-handedly revolutionize the interest in the sport in this part of the world. This is a man, when asked on TV about his views on mandatory drug testing, responded, "I've tried just about all of them, but I wouldn't want to make it mandatory." JC, that is a man that you want to spend some time with having a beer.
Absolutely. Well, or something else, Goldie, in your case. I think just got to be careful to keep within the law. I appreciate that he wants to get one of my books. I would send it to his address, but I think his address is like Vermont, the forest.
Exactly. He lives. The guy lives in a log cabin in the middle of the woods, deep in Vermont. He has no Wi-Fi. He has no cellular phone signal. I'm not a slave to technology. And so he had to go to his publisher's to do that interview with me. and what a great guy he was. And I tell you what, there's stuff that he said in that interview that obviously didn't make the final edit, and I don't think ever should, because this is a family show. It's a family show. Yes.
But he's an amazing guy, not just a really good baseball player, but you think about what he's done in terms of continuing to play baseball, whether it be amateur or professional. He's now in his 70s, 73 years old, but also what he's done with regards to Cuban baseball for MLB as an ambassador since 99, what he's done in the world of charity. This is a great guy with a big, big heart. I loved him, JC.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the discussion you brought up about being in an altered state, being a pitcher. It reminds me of the story, of course, of Doc Ellis, who threw a no-hitter on LSD. So I think that there is room for that kind of player in baseball.
Yeah, but we don't recommend it, kids.
No, not in the amateur sport. British baseball, keep it straight and narrow.
There you go.
Super stuff. Okay, time now for the seventh inning stretch. Now, Eric, it's a rather obvious one. For me, if you're not going to mention Spaceman, A Space Odyssey, Spaceman movie as your movie of the week, and if you're not going to mention one of his, four or five books that he's involved in as your book of the week.
It's JC's turn.
No, it's not. This is the hot week where I'm fully in agreement with Eric. Ignore JC and focus on the legend that is William Francis Lee.
Hey, let's face it. With such a great guy involved, every single book that Bill Lee has written is hilarious. As you mentioned in the interview, The Wrong Stuff, if you know, Thomas Wolfe wrote The Right Stuff, what better player to have adopted this title than The Wrong Stuff than Bill Lee? It's hilarious. I recommend The Wrong Stuff. You gotta put it on your baseball bookshelf, as is Baseball Eccentrics, another one of his books that he's written. Have Glove Will Travel, as he mentioned in that interview, is another one. Basically, just Google Bill Lee, baseball player, whatever book he's written, buy it. I guarantee you'll be in stitches.
JC, have you seen the film Spaceman? I mean, I know it's biographical, so it's not really a film.
It's the film is actually, I will say, not as good as it should have been. But if you want to move on to baseball movie of the week, don't worry about Spaceman the movie, which was the biography of Billy. I say this year, this week's baseball movie recommendation is going back to 1994. Another unsung film. People really haven't really heard of it much. It's called Little Big League. Basically, a story about a 12-year-old boy who inherits the Minnesota Twins.
Terrible movie.
What am I all about? I'm about it's so bad it's good.
No, and it's a ripoff, right? Did you ever see The Kid from Left Field?
Yes.
There were two versions of it. So the original was 1959 with Lloyd Bridges and Anne Bancroft. But my favorite was the one with Gary Coleman, where he ends up
it's San Diego Padres with Ed McMahon.
Best line ever was from Tom Shales of the Washington Post, who said, "There's no point listing credits because no credit is due." And this movie is of that ilk. It's the same plot and equally as bad.
Oh, come on. I think it's the perfect, if you want to get kids into baseball, Little Big League, about a 12-year-old boy who inherits the Minnesota Twins. You got cameos from Randy Johnson. You got cameos from Ken Griffey Jr.
The better movie from that era is Rookie of the Year.
I prefer Little Big League.
You're wrong. You are just.
I got the bell.
Excuse me. I obviously have to be the voice of reason here. You're obviously both going head to head, so I'm coming in as the neutral, and I want to say I'm with Eric for the simple reason I made my film debut in my epic acting career in the movie Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, described by Time Out magazine as, and I quote, "the worst film in cinematography history." If you're not going to be the best, be the worst. We are not going mid-table mediocrity. But I'm with you, Eric.
It could have been even worse. You got cut. You were left on the cutting room floor. Think about what you could have done to that film.
I deliberately didn't mention that. Thank you so much for bringing up the fact that I wasn't.
Happy birthday, Gouldie. Happy birthday.
The worst film ever made.
Okay. Anyways, moving on from movies, because we let our listeners and viewers decide. Little Big League, yay or nay. Anyways, let Johnny decide. Let him see it. Moving on. Baseball TV reference. Now, I think the best baseball referenced thing in a television show, Curb Your Enthusiasm. If you go to season 8, episode 9, Bill Buckner makes an appearance on the show. And I'm telling you, It's one of the funniest things you've ever seen, and also therapeutic for Bill Buckner after what happened to him in 1986 when the ball went between his legs in that Game 6 World Series. It is what I can't stress enough. If you can somehow find Curb Your Enthusiasm, Season 8, Episode 9, It's Bill Buckner. It's just
I love Bill Buckner. Of course, before he played for the Red Sox, he played for the Cubs and the Los Angeles Dodgers. He was so maligned because of that ground ball. And keep in mind, he had bad legs, bad knees at that point. It was really hard for him to get down. He had been a huge contributor to that team, but he was so maligned in New England that he had to leave. And always tried to keep a good spirit about it. So I have never seen that reference in Curb Your Enthusiasm, but I'm going to check it out. Hopefully, if it does right by him, then I'm going to support that one, Eric.
He was skeptical doing it at first. I can't give any spoilers, but it helped him move on from that 1986, even though the Red Sox won 8-0-4 and 0-7 by the time that episode was made, 2011. He said it actually helped the healing process of
you got to put it on our social media.
It'll be on our social medias and every platform. Moving on. That's the end of the same thing in stretch, because now it's time for the answer of the trivia. And just to reiterate, I asked you which father-son combo combined for the most home runs. And I'm thinking...
Well, it's an obvious one, isn't it? Which I won't mention because it's obvious, which is probably the right answer.
Okay,
The only other one that I can think of that's definitely... They were two great, great players is, of course, the Griffeys. Ken Griffey Jr. and Sr.
And they hit back-to-back home runs in a game.
I mean, that's the right. They played together.
Would that have been? To hit a home run with dad. Oh, my Lord. So
cool. In Major League Baseball.
I think you're right, Goldie, because I think the obvious answer has to go with the home run king in Barry Bonds. And his dad, Bobby Bonds, is a great player, too. I think his career was kind of a little less than what it should have been, but he was a fantastic player. So I'd go with the Bonds as Goldie.
I 100% agree, buddy. And in fact, I'm looking it up now because
Here's the thing, because I mean, tell you right now, because people think Barry and Bobby Bonds would be the highest father son combo, but Ken Griffey Jr. and Ken Griffey Sr. total home runs 782, and the Bonds. Yeah, 1,094.
Okay. For sure.
Close. I know. I mean, even if you take away just Ken Griffey Sr.'s home runs, that's only 20 less than just Barry Bonds on his own. So there you go.
Do we still have an asterisk on Barry Bonds? I hate the fact that he is the all-time home runner, if I'm brutally honest. Primarily because, of course, he took the record off Hank Aaron, who is just such a wonderful, wonderful human being. I still feel a bit grieved about that. What's your thoughts, boys?
You know, baseball's baseball, and the stats reflect a time and a place. And I think that this is one of the great misunderstandings, which is we want there to be continuity through stats. That's what baseball always tries to sell itself as, is that you can compare a player from the 1920s with a player from the 2020s. And the reality is that each of these players played in a different time. So it's nearly impossible to do. You know, Ty Cobb didn't have to play against African-American players. How did that affect his stats? Barry Bonds played in the steroids era. He was not the only person to use steroids. So I say, this, unfortunately, I agree with you. It hurts my heart because I love Hank Aaron, but the stat, the record is the record.
It is the record, but you look at the number of home runs he was hitting at the end of his career when they should have been in decline, and in fact, they went the opposite way. And we know for a fact that Hank Aaron was totally clean. And that, for me, is why it should never have been allowed, and it should have an asterisk, because there's no question in my mind, the greatest home run hitter of all time is Hank Aaron. End off.
Yeah, Hank Aaron did play in the era of greenies, and I'm not saying he did any sort of amphetamines or any of those drugs. I do not know, and I wouldn't ever suggest that. But he did play in an era where there was drug use, too. I mean, all of these eras have stains on them. All of them are imperfect. I realize that it's easier to understand the connection between steroids and performance-enhancing drugs and home runs. But again, you play in the era you play in, and it is what it is.
Bottom line is the jury will be out for quite a while.
Yeah. Okay. Bell's gone. Time now for the mailbag. Yet again, we've had loads of questions in. Massive thanks to you all. The obvious one, guys, we've put it at the top of the show. It is the big story. It's about COVID and it's about will the season be seen out. Molly at Blue Heart says, do you think it will survive? I personally don't see us getting to playoffs, but also think it will take something drastic to happen before it stops. Ben Bright, that's at Brighty. He similarly says MLB seems to have its coronavirus protocols all wrong. And he makes the very good reference to the English Premier League and just four positive tests since the restart. And yet MLB, it seems to be completely out of control, certainly in two clubs. Is MLB simply a reflection of generally shambolic approach to the coronavirus across the US? We're getting political. Mark Doody, Liz Britton, they're both saying the same things. Is it going to be cancelled? What's your thoughts, boys? Do you think we can possibly get to the end of this season?
I think there's going to need to be a tremendous change in approach, and whether it's the protocols or the way the players are approaching protocols, there's going to have to be some serious lockdown. And I think even if that happens, I'm not 100% sure it's going to occur. And, you know, one of the issues and one of the grousings that are legitimate is here in the United States, there's a question about whether there's enough testing and enough speed in which people get their answers to their tests as to whether they're positive or negative. This is true with Major League Baseball, but even more true with everyday people. And a lot of people are a little frustrated that athletes are getting this preferential treatment. So, you know, there's just so many issues involved with this. And I would say still flip of a coin, but in order for it to come up the right way, there's going to need to be a lot of changes to give it that shot.
Eric, Liz Britton says, if the season gets cancelled, is there any chance the podcast will continue in some form during the off season? And will you be back next year? Well, we're definitely going to come back next year. I'm pretty sure we could say that. But what's your thoughts about continuing if the season is off?
We'll try our darndest. We'll try to find some exciting things to talk about without using the waffle prop.
Can we talk curling? Can we do a little preseason curling discussion?
There's a huge
come on, all our
that,
listeners. I want to see grassroots support for curling.
So I think we can conclude there that if there's baseball of some sorts, baseball stories to talk about, we'll be on air. Yeah?
Let's just face it, when the World Series ends, it'll be just before the regular flu season begins. Let's just try to get there somehow safely.
Okay, I want to get through as many. Okay, I want to get through as many as possible. So this one, I'm going to do one person for one answer. This one's yours, JC. Favorite commentator, Anthony J. Do you have any favorite play-by-play commentators? He's not a Giants fan, but often listens to their radio feed, just to hear John Miller. Cannot agree more with you, Anthony. Love, love, love John Miller.
Yeah, for me, unfortunately, he's retired, was Vin Scully, without a doubt. He harkens back to my childhood. He was able to go high and low culture all the time. He would say things that you wouldn't even know about and would have to look up because he was so erudite, and then really talk about the basics of baseball. He was the man for me.
Well, we were spoiled, weren't they? John Miller and Joe Morgan was always a great partnership. But I like Rick Sutcliffe. He always used to make me laugh. So there were plenty. Eric, this one's for you. Baseball movies. Ross Ellis at Ross Ellis Tweets. What did you guys make of the film adaptation of Moneyball?
It was fine. It was true to the
That's
book.
Not exactly
it was
a ringing exactly. endorsement.
Eric, I like how nuanced you are with that one.
Siskel Ebert, move over. No, it's basically, I always thought the book was unfilmable. I thought, like, there's no way they can make a film of this book after reading it. But I think they did a great job.
Yeah, I loved it. I've watched it about three times. Not that I'm sad or anything. Blue Jays. This is from Blue Jays Fans UK Baseball at Blue Jays Fans UK. This one's for you, JC. Nate Pearson. Discuss. Grinning face with smiling eyes. And I'll just add into the mix here, guys. Just spent virtually 40% of my waiver budget picking him up in my fantasy baseball team. Yeah, baby. Talk to me about Nate Pearson, JC.
Waffles come out again.
Nate Pearson, excellent pitcher, and he is a reflection of one of the unique elements to the season, which is that you're getting these sort of phenom young pitchers who probably wouldn't have reached the major leagues if it was a 162-game season because maybe inning counts, maybe just because of the nature of the year and the players would have been healthy, getting the opportunity to pitch in the big leagues. Brady Singer is another example with the Royals, and I think this adds a lot of excitement to the game as the game continues, if it continues.
Next letter.
Okay, this one, early surprise teams. This is for both of you, so you can go first, Eric. Charlie Baldwin, we love Charlie, always gets in touch. Which early surprise teams do you believe can keep it going for all 60 games? I mean, Colorado Rockies are leading in the West. That's definitely a surprise.
No, yeah. You know what? I'm going to say it's too early to tell.
I think what's amazing is that you look at The San Francisco Giants, the Detroit Tigers, and the Baltimore Orioles, they all have records over 500. The sample size is so small. The one team, and this is not a surprise, I know who's, this team was picked as sort of a dark horse, but that I think could be really good throughout the year, the San Diego Padres. You look at their rotation, Chris Paddock, Dinelson Lamet, Garrett Richards, if he's healthy, and Zach Davies. Those are four really good under-the-radar pitchers who could really carry them a far way.
And yep, one quirky fact as well, that did you know that no team in the history, is the first time in the history of baseball, no team went 3-0.
Is that right?
That's right. No team went 3-0. First time in baseball history.
And guys, we should give a mention because they rarely get anything positive said about them. Detroit Tigers, 5-3, sitting second in the AL Central, 625.
It's still too early. You got in two games.
My boy Johnny Schreiber, who we interviewed last week, it's the Johnny and Josh Show podcast bump. He's two scoreless outings.
Yes, really.
Pitch, no Schreiber hits, no watch. Walks, and a strikeout.
We're no longer a jinx. Okay, three batter minimum rule. I'm going to have to cut this one down, but it's from Carl Richard Taylor. He's clearly a massive pitching fan. He says, is it just me, or is the new three batter rule for relief pitchers confusing? He says, I love pitching. It's disheartening to see spot starters, openers, and going no more than four innings along with this mixed up rule. My question is, do the pitching rules need an overhaul? This one's for you, JC.
Yeah, I mean, I stated this on the first show, is that I don't like this rule at all because I think that it diminishes strategy. That you don't, you know, they're trying to do it to speed up games, and it just doesn't create as much value in speed up games as it does take away from the strategy. I miss loogies already, the left-handed one-out guys. So I'm in complete agreement. I would like to see that rule roll back. I don't think we need to overhaul pitching rules. There have been changes over the years. 1920, they got rid of the spitball. And after 1968, they lowered the mound from 15 to 10 inches. So, you know, there have always been changes, but I think that this is one that's wrong.
Okay. One more.
Okay, well, apologies then to Jim Hudson, who wanted to talk about Joe Kelly. Interesting point he makes, though. Joe Kelly, of course, was with the 2018 Boston Red Sox, and we all know what a cloud that's under. Anyway, that's just throwing that one out there. Phil Palmer, sign stealing. After last week's discussions on sign stealing and cheating, I saw Josh Chetwynd say somewhere he deliberately leant over the plate to get a hit by pitch. Is this gamesmanship, or is it cheating, JC? Like not walking in cricket if you know you've nicked it. I walk every time. I catch a nick, I'm out of there.
Look, is it on the line? Yes. But the sanction is immediate if you do it wrong. I did this dozens of times in my career if I would get down the count. If you go onto our Facebook page, the Johnny and Josh Show, no H in Johnny, you'll see that I've actually put up a video, a game in college I played, was on TV, and I actually did exactly what we were talking about. And you'll see it's an art form. If you do it right, it doesn't look like you're trying to lean into it. You can't do it if it's a ball over the plate, but if it's
close. It's not an art form. I've seen the art video. You look like Kevin Costner in The Bodyguard. You're throwing yourself in front of Whitney Houston. It's...
Oh, Goldie.
That's
like the dizzy bat race all over again. You're deluded. You were waiting this whole show to get to this point so that you could totally try and slag off my getting hit by a pitch efforts.
Well, Dave Harbour even wants to know how your knees are. And he goes on to say, but on a more serious note, if you're a catcher, and I assume Dave is, what can you do to improve your position behind the plate to protect those knees? You can't. Look at you. You're an amazing athlete once, and now you're walking around like an old man.
I was actually really durable until I had a collision at home plate. Someone basically blew out my knee. And then I went back to catching and got a 6-millimeter divot in my femur from grinding it down. So once you're injured, it was downhill. But before that, I was pretty good. It's an interesting question because there actually have been changes just recently to the way catchers set up on deliveries compared to previous seasons. And take a look at Gary Sanchez, and he'll be a really good example of this. He actually gets down on one knee, even with runners on base, in order to have a lower target to help with this framing, and that will also help your knees. Tony Perez back in the day, Tony Pena, not Tony Perez, Tony Pena with the Pirates, did something similar where you get down on one knee and catch balls low in order to keep his knees in a better condition when there was no one on base. But now we're even changing to when players are on base because arms are so strong. I'm old school. I think you need to get in a crouch and you deal with it. But if you want to look at Sanchez as an example of a way to protect your knees, that's the person to look to.
All right. Oh.
Eric.
Now, on that note, I say one more. And
For those at home who don't know what the hell's just happened, he's yeah, hit the bell so hard.
It was like a Benny Hill episode.
I said one more two emails ago, but that was still a valid question to ask anyways. So moving on, and I can't reach the bell anymore.
Well, that's it, guys. Thank you so much. JC, Eric, you've been such great company. Bill Lee, what an absolute legend. Don't forget, you can check out the whole of that interview, bar the really dodgy bits, and that's going to be a part of our add-on. And, of course, the fantasy baseball that we're doing with James Holden. That's all extras, free for you legends, you listeners of the Johnny and Josh Show. Check us out on Facebook, the Johnny and Josh Show, or on Twitter, on Instagram, at Johnny and Josh. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you become a part of the family. And make sure you join us this time next week.